Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
It's for you. Sarah Calvert, as I promised you, is our special guest. Sarah is our good friend. She's been with us for a long time now. We've been talking about what her program that she calls 101 Ways to Avoid Liability in Your Small Business. And Sarah is the principal in Calvert & Associates, B.C., a law firm that she founded in 1991 out of Fairfax, Virginia. And she is a member of our Brain Trust. Sarah, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you back with us. And where we are now is, as we actually wrap up this section today, this series that we've been doing on how to avoid liability in your small business. Sarah, I want to thank you very much for your steadfastness, for your
for 101 different things.
Your generosity of your time and the good job that you've done with us. I really appreciate that, and I know my audience does too.
No problem. I bet you thought we'd never see the end of this 101.
Well,
more like 1,001 after we got.
I've really enjoyed. Well, of course, you know that's the reason. That's the beauty of the conversation, isn't it? That we start out with an idea and we flesh it out a little bit. That's the beauty of what we're doing here. The first thing that we've got on the list today is something that I think is really, really important, and it actually speaks more, in my opinion, to a mindset, the
Absolutely.
Way you think of yourself, than it does anything technical, and that is, do you treat yourself as an employee of your corporation as well as the owner?
This is kind of a multi-layered question, but the reason it's here is to remind people there's a lot of people out there that think that if they're the only person in the business, or maybe there's one or two employees and just themselves as an owner, that the business is really them and they are the business. And that is completely incorrect. You really have to take yourself and understand that your business is an entity that stands on its own in the corner of the room, has its own life, has its own existence, its own identification.
And it won't die just because you die.
That's
or
right.
It won't move just because
right.
you move or whatever.
Right. It even though you created it, it is a separate creation and it is separate from you. And I think the business owners that understand this are best able to make plans for that business, to protect that business, and to not walk around saying that anything I believe and do is the corporation, because that's where they get in trouble sometimes.
Well, my audience has heard me say before these words, which sort of conflict a little bit with what you were just saying, not in reality, but in and that is that it's hard to separate, it's almost impossible to separate me from my business. But I'm thinking, and when I do that, when I'm talking about that, I'm talking about the way I live my life,
right.
not the way I structure my company, and I structure the relationship between me and my company.
Right, and I'm not saying that your ethics and your beliefs are not part of the company.
Exactly.
As I said, it's more like a parent and a child. You've created an entity that, you know, if you raise it right, has your ethics, has your beliefs, has your guidance. However, it's still a separate entity, and you work for that entity. And there's some tax issues involved there. There's some legal issues involved there. And more importantly, there's some deep psychological issues that a lot of us business owners cannot separate ourselves mentally enough to be able to realize that we're creating something. It isn't us. When I see a business fail, for example, and someone comes into my office for a bankruptcy, they're absolutely crushed, and rightfully so. They've developed something, created something, and they're very sad that it's gone. But it was not their identity. It shouldn't have been. It was an entity separate from them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I urge people to, in the many faceted way that we're talking about, to, while you want to grow this business, you know, with the same beliefs and the same issues that you bring to the table, it is a separate entity. You know, the IRS is going to keep it as a separate entity, so you can't play commingle funds and that kind of thing. The Corporation Commission is going to see it as a separate entity. It's not you. And as I said, that even that psychological level of separation.
Well, there are some ways of thinking about this that help. I think that helps people, and I try to point these out when I'm talking to people about this very issue. And that is, number one, as an individual, you can be part of this company. I'm not even going to call it your company. I'm going to call it this company.
Mm-hmm.
You can be part of this company in a handful of ways. You can be a stockholder.
Mm-hmm.
You can be a board member.
Mm-hmm.
You can be an officer.
Mm-hmm.
You can be an employee.
Right.
And you can be a creditor.
Mm-hmm.
You can be a landlord.
You can be a debtor.
And you could be a debtor. That's right. That's six or seven or eight different things.
There's probably 20 more.
There probably are. That you could be with this company. And the thing is, you could be one or two or three, any combination of those.
Mm-hmm.
And just like anybody else could be who's not even one of the founders of that company.
That's right.
But one of the main things is that I really think that helps to highlight this to people is when you actually help them work up a lease,
mm-hmm,
for a piece of real estate,
mm-hmm,
that the company occupies and uses to operate its business, but yet the company doesn't own that real estate. You as the individual own that real estate, and you are renting that building, that property, to this company. That sort of helps people to understand that. That helps them understand the separation.
And it is truly that separation. It may not be as arm's length as many other relationships, but it certainly is a separate relationship.
And the real watershed event is when they actually write themselves a rent check, mm-hmm, from their own company.
Right. Or how about selling the business someday?
Yeah.
That's, of course, a real eye-opening experience when you sell the assets and the value and the goodwill that you built up over the year in this business that seemed like it was you, and suddenly somebody's walking around with it that's different from you. So.
Absolutely. And you mentioned something earlier. You used the word commingle.
Mm-hmm.
And that's such an important word,
yeah,
to understand in this particular issue. And that is, folks, that the money that you take in your business does not belong to you.
No.
It does not belong to you. It belongs to this entity that you founded.
And it first must pay the debts of the business and pay for the assets of the business. And it is not grocery money until certain precautions are taken.
I never know the bank balance on any given day in my businesses,
mm-hmm,
because it's not. I mean, I don't think of it that way. I don't think of it like you do your personal account. All right, I've got $100 in my personal account. You can't think of your business.
Oh, don't do that.
Stand by, Sarah. We got to take a break, folks. It's 20 after the hour. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. We'll be right back. All right, we're back. It's 24 after. Thank you very much for joining us. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. Our phone number is 888-822-8255. If you'd like to talk to me or my special guest and our good friend Sarah Calvert, our small business attorney, 888-822-8255. You just give us a call. Sarah, I want to stay with this subject for another minute or two on treating yourself as an employee of your corporation as well as the owner. You really have to think, you have to learn to partition your thoughts in any given day so that you can move back and forth from being a, as I said earlier, you know, in any given day, you may have to act like a board member.
Mm-hmm.
You may have to act like an officer.
Mm-hmm.
You may have to act like a employee. You may have to act like a landlord. All the different things that we talked about. In any given day, the people who I think are the most successful are the people who can move back and forth from each one of those partitions.
Those slightly schizophrenic individuals.
Exactly.
Yes.
but if in my opinion, one of the best things you can do to someone, especially if they're just starting out in small business, is to help them understand how to move back and forth and to understand the dynamics of each one of those.
Well, I think it's very important to know what these roles are all about. You can't play a role you don't know and don't understand. I find that many of my clients who got on the internet and incorporated themselves and then went about their business doing their business, in a lot of cases didn't have anybody explain to them that there are at least three significant corporate-level roles. You know, aside from your role as a landlord or your role as an employee and possibly an employer, you know, the corporate-level roles are very distinctive, and those who understand them seem to have a better time moving in and amongst them and documenting the things they need to document and separating where they need to separate. You know, the shareholder sounds like something everybody would understand. It's an owner of a corporation. It's the one that actually bought shares. It's the entity and the person that invested the money and the time and the effort to start that business. And that's a distinctive role that, frankly, does not play a day-to-day role or even a month-to-month or even sometimes a year-to-year role.
Right.
It is simply an investor and a starter and an entrepreneur. The director of the business is usually hired by the shareholders. Usually there's a, you know, in a big corporation like GM or IBM, it would be a slate of directors. But in your case, it's probably just you.
Mm-hmm.
But your role as a director is as a guiding force for the business. You may meet quarterly as a director. You may meet as much as monthly as a director. Or you may just meet once a year as a director. But your role as a director is much more hands-on and much more guiding and overall policymaking.
And if you are about to do something to your corporation, you're about to maybe take some money or you're about to use something or whatever it might be, and if you might want to stop and say, okay,
who am I?
Would I let another at this moment I'm an employee of this company.
Mm-hmm.
Would I let another employee do this?
Mm-hmm.
What would board members think of an employee if they did this? What would board members think of an officer if they did this, or a stockholder if they did this? You have to look at it that way. And we're being a little hard on you here, but it's tough love, isn't it, Sarah?
That's right. Yeah, you got to love these roles. Now that officer role is the one that does the day to day actions. It's probably the skin you will live in the most.
That's the
president, secretary, vice president, treasurer.
Right.
You're probably all of those things. But the one you walk around with most is the title of president. And which is
an employee.
Exactly, it's an employee. It works for the board of directors and the shareholders. And can be fired at any time for doing something wrong. It's not a position that is guaranteed in a corporation like a shareholder position may be.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the position that most people do their banking in, the position that most people do their day-to-day, everyday work in the business. And as you say, it's completely an employee of the entity, of the corporation, or of the business.
Right.
And people just really need to understand, when they move out of that presidential role into more of a director or shareholder role, or even more into I'm the landlord today. I got to make sure I pay my rent today, whether it's to me or not to me.
One of the things to make sure that sort of should slow you up just a little bit if you're in the process of commingling funds is when money comes into your business. Always deposit every penny of that money into the company bank account. Never put any of that into your personal bank account. And by having to write the check from your company to you, that's a whole other process that should slow you down just a little bit.
Keep you out of the IRS's
club. Yeah, exactly. Stand by. It's 29 after the hour. We're going to move on when we come back with Sarah Calvert, our special guest and our resident small business attorney. 888-822-8255. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. Stay with us. We are back. It's 33 after. Thank you for joining me. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and my website is www.smallbusinessadvocate.com. Thank you, those of you who've been signing my guest book, those of you who've been visiting the site and dropping me an email telling me, just saying hello or making a comment or whatever you like. I really appreciate that. That means a lot to me. Sarah Calvert is our special guest. She's our small business attorney in residence at the Small Business Advocate Show and a member of our Brain Trust. And she operates out of Fairfax, Virginia. And if you would like to contact her, here is her phone number.
It's 800-526-5665. And if you're on the web and you're visiting Jim, come see me at www.calvert.com.
And if you're noodling around on my site and you find her, then you'll find a link to her.
That's right, and vice versa.
Exactly, absolutely. Do I sound a little gravelly voice this morning, Sarah?
Yes, you sound a little.
I don't know. I don't know what's going on here. I don't feel hoarse, but I think I may sound a little bit that way. Anyway, I hope it's not too bad. Let's move on.
Well, take care of yourself, because the next thing we're going to talk about is first aid kits.
I need to go get some of my grandma's up medicine, you know, the whiskey and the bourbon and honey and all that.
Oh, is that what cures what you got?
After the next break, during the next break, I may go fix me up a little toddy there.
Now that doesn't belong particularly in a first aid cabinet, maybe in a liquor cabinet.
All right. Well, what do you got about first aid?
All right. I know this sounds like something that's a little silly, but there are OSHA requirements, and that's that Occupational Safety and Health Administration requirements, that each job site be it your home or be it an office with employees, have certified first aid kits. And you'll see them, they're OSHA certified for 15 and under. That's what most of us are, you know, 15
God
and under.
God bless our friends at OSHA.
Yeah, really. They're a little scary sometimes. And this first aid kit has things like Band-Aids and, you know, tweezers and things like that. You're not trying to perform surgery or anything here, but make sure that you have first aid kits. First of all, it's a good employee thing. Second of all, this is something that, you know, a disgruntled employee who happens to know that you should have one and don't, could call OSHA in. We're not going to see it too much in the office places, but any of you in the mechanical businesses of any kind, this is just absolutely critical. Because if you've got people fooling around with machinery or fixing cars or building houses or, you know, putting up whatever,
somebody's going to get hurt.
Somebody's going to get hurt, and if there's absolutely no way that your company has of taking care of that person until emergency help arrives or of taking care of a minor injury, not only are you building ill will, but you're also violating the law. The other big issue that's related to this is safety equipment.
Mm-hmm.
If there is safety equipment that goes with the machinery that you are using in your shop, and you do not enforce the use of that equipment, you yourself could be sued, even though you're not the one who didn't use it.
Even if you have a policy?
Even if you have a policy. Now, the policy should be written, but guess what, Jim? That policy has to be enforced.
If the guy's out on the job, and I have a policy, and I've given him the equipment, mm-hmm. and I've told him to use it, and I've seen him using it,
mm-hmm.
and he goes out on a job, and he doesn't use it, and he gets hurt.
You're more likely to be in trouble if you give him a policy and you know he's not following the policy and you don't discipline him in some way.
If I have some knowledge that he's not following it.
Yes, yeah. I mean, if it's the one time in a million that he didn't happen to put those safety goggles on
right.
because he couldn't find them or he forgot they were on top of his head, like some of us who lose our glasses do,
mm-hmm.
That's a different story. But if we're talking about somebody who everyone knows doesn't use that ladder correctly, or doesn't wear their safety goggles, or doesn't wear the breathing equipment in a paint booth. You know, everyone knows it's too hot outside, so nobody's going to do it, and the boss has a policy, but the boss doesn't enforce it. Well, guess what? OSHA says that's the boss's fault, not the stupid employee's fault.
Mm-hmm. It's always the boss's fault.
Yeah, well, that's right. Yes, as we were talking about roles in your business before, you know, one of your roles is to be the scapegoat for all these.
Yeah, we forgot to mention that, didn't we?
Yeah, we forgot to mention
that. We forgot the scapegoat factor.
You are at fault. You are guilty before you even get started.
Exactly. Until you're guilty,
exactly.
You're assumed to be guilty until you're proven innocent.
But safety is such a huge issue. And by the way, this will bring down your cost tremendously if you do have these. If you are truly vigilant about your enforcing your safety policies, you will bring your insurance costs down where they're very expensive for most mechanical businesses.
Right.
So.
Well, and the other thing is if you have other employees who can say, yes, the company has a policy, yes, the boss has trained us in this, yes, the boss has told us to do this or that,
mm-hmm.
then that sort of negates someone else from trying to refute that in court.
That's true. But you've got to make sure that it's not one of those, yeah, we wrote it down, but nobody listens to it policies.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that's not going to do any good in this particular case.
Okay, totally different subject.
Yes, we
do
keep around it miscellaneous.
Do you keep good files so you can put your hands on important documents easily? One of the things that absolutely saves my bacon every day is the good filing system that my lovely assistant has created for me over the last several years. And most of the time I can find it, but all the time she can find it.
Well, that's what's important. But as business owners, we know sometimes our employees come and go, so there's no sense in having a system that only your assistant can follow.
One of the things that just absolutely has saved me so many times, when we started doing the show almost 2 years ago, she started developing really, really good files. And now, if I need something, if I say, okay, what about this idea, something we pulled out, you know, maybe a year ago or more, she knows exactly where it is. And most of the time, I can find it.
Mm-hmm.
So that really makes you more productive. And we're going to talk about some of the legal aspects of that when we come back after this break. It's 39 after the hour. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. Sarah Calvert is our special guest. Our phone number is 888-822-8255. Stay with us, please. All right, we're back. It's 44 after. Thank you for joining us. Our phone number is 888-822-8255. Sarah Calvert is our special guest. And our good friend Sarah, we're talking about keeping good files. And obviously there are practical business reasons for keeping good files, but there are also some good legal reasons for keeping good files, aren't there?
I'm telling you that the clients that walk in my door with their contracts in hand when somebody is not paying them, and all the documentation are the people whose judgments I can get for them. Those who I write off to and say, okay, now give me the original contract for this court case, and say, gee, we can't find it,
right.
are those that I most often can't prove what's going on. You know, you go to all this trouble and you spend all this money with a lawyer on how to write this contract, how to get this contract signed, how to negotiate this contract, and then you lose the original contract. And that happens, and in some cases, we can't ever prove the contract ever existed. So you need to make sure that you've got good files and that you've got secure files, because contracts that are not beneficial to employees, like non-competes and things like that, have a tendency to get up and walk out if people know where they are.
Well, you know, this is an area where my audience has heard me own up to being a pack rat. And this is where being a pack rat is a good thing.
It's a good thing, yes, as long as you're organized pack rat.
That's true. That's true. Because my clients, whom I've been working with, some of them now for 10 years, over 10 years, I had a guy call me yesterday. Literally, this is a true story. He called yesterday, and he said, Jim, he said, remember that project we worked on about 8 years ago? Actually, he didn't even know how long ago it was, but I figured out that it was about 8 years ago. He said, you remember that project? And I remember the project. I did not remember the year until later. And I said, yes. He says, do you still have that?
Oh, my goodness.
And I says, yes, I do. And he said, well, you have it hard copy? I said, yes, and on a computer disk. And he said, well, I need to get that back out and modify it for this other thing that I'm doing. And
wow.
we have it here.
Wow.
That's where being
a
pack rat is a good thing.
Yeah, but what about your computer files, Jim? Do you have them backed up off-site?
Let's move into that.
Yeah?
Yeah, because that's your next point.
That's something that I can't stress enough, because having everything backed up on the computer doesn't do you any good when the computer crashes.
Or if you have it on a floppy, mm-hmm. off of your hard drive, and the building burns.
No, it doesn't do you any good whatsoever. So at least once a week, if you've got lots of valuable data, or if you only occasionally need a backup once a month, take that disk home. It's so easy to do. You swap it for the one that's there. You bring it back. You only need two to do the whole project.
Let me tell you something else. In today's world, there is no excuse for not being able to do that. Now, we all know about the 100 megabyte zip drives.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times, you know, most of us who've been around for a long time and who have a lot of computer stuff, 100 megabytes, I mean, that'll get a lot of stuff, but it won't get everything. And the ideal thing would be to have almost everything you've got on one or two mediums. And the thing that today you can buy a tape drive,
yep.
that'll hold 3 or 4 gigabytes,
mm-hmm.
for like $300.
And they don't even take that long to back up.
No. Well, you just leave your computer on one night, for example, or you go to lunch,
yeah.
and turn it on, and it copies it over. And as you say, you take that out and you take it home with you.
That's right.
Or whatever you do with it.
And then round about December 15th, you back the whole sucker up. Take it home. Take any home records into the office and make sure you're ready for Y2K with a backup file.
Real life story.
Yep.
Azriella Jaffe, one of the authors that's on our show and has been with us several times. She's an author. She makes her living that way. And everything that she has is in her house. And about 2 months ago, the weekend before she was going to be on the show on Monday, she had a house fire.
Oh, dear.
Now, they contained it. It didn't hurt anything. But she said, you know what? I am going to be backing up in earnest now, because she had backed up, but she had not gotten it out of the house.
Oh.
She said, Jim, all the years that all my work would have gone up in flames.
That's a scary thought.
Well, think about that.
I was working for my husband when I was in law school, and he's an accountant, as you may have heard me say, and it was April 14th. The deadline this year was the 16th because it was a Sunday, 15th, and we had not had a chance to back up because we were right in the midst of the deepest of the tax season, and we lost the motherboard on our main network drive. And they spent almost 24 hours straight rebuilding the motherboard and replacing the files that lost all their first initials.
Yep.
Spent thousands and thousands of dollars, all because we had not, you know, we'd been so busy we hadn't backed up.
Lesson learned.
Oh, man.
Enough said.
I learned that one. There's also insurance for that, by the way. So make sure you've got a good insurance on that.
But that won't recreate those files.
No, but it'll help pay for the damage that you do to yourself.
And if you're a creative person, if you're a writer, if you've got things in there, mm-hmm. that came out of your head once,
mm-hmm.
and you can, it's hard to get those things back out of your head from memory. I mean, mm-hmm. that's
You know, and Jim, we're talking about some natural disasters or personal disasters. There's a couple things that, you know, one of these worst case scenarios that I want you to think about as a business owner. One is, what happens if you become disabled suddenly? What if you're in a car crash? If you've got employees or ongoing obligations, not only do you want to have something very nice like business continuation insurance, but you should have some sort of plan. You know, if you've got, somebody's got to go pay those bills, somebody's got to be on that bank account or able to get on that bank account. If you're flat on your back, you've got to have some sort of backup to make sure that your obligations get met, or breaking a contract just because you're flat on your back doesn't necessarily, you know, hold water with a large corporation that's relying on you to produce something. So if you've got a business that relies on deadlines and contracts being met, make sure you've got some sort of backup plan if you should become disabled in
some
way.
We're going to be coming up. We got to take a break here in a second. When we come back, I want you to remember this, because I want you to tell us what that backup plan should look like. It's 50 after the hour, folks. Thank you for joining us. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. We're visiting with our good friend Sarah Calvert. We're talking about 101 ways to avoid liability in your small business. We'll be right back. Don't go away. We are shaking it up with our resident small business attorney, Sarah Calvert. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and we're wrapping up our series on 101 ways to avoid liability in your small business. And Sarah, I want to thank you again. I know we've got some other topics that we're going to be talking about when you come back for our next visits, but we are leaving this series, and I want you to know that I think it's been an excellent segment. I know my audience has gotten a lot out of it, and I appreciate you. Let's talk about, you were going to tell us about the strategy. This is the plan.
We're talking ultimate worst case scenarios. The first one we're talking about is you're flat on your back in bed, you're disabled, you're unconscious, you're in a coma. It's really a smart thing to have some sort of contingency plan. If you are in the business alone, maybe a relative or somebody who is familiar with your business would know where to go to get a packet that would have keys to any offices or any locked file drawers or any passcodes that would have maybe assigned a card that would allow them at that time to have access to your bank accounts, maybe assigned power of attorney that isn't used until, you know, this kind of situation.
In other words, they don't have to be a co-signer on
power
of attorney in the event that you
power
are
attorney,
incapacitated
yes.
or dead.
Exactly.
That does the job.
Yes, well, not dead. The power of attorney work if you're incapacitated. They don't work if you're dead.
Okay.
Yeah, they only work if you're incapacitated. If there was some sort of natural disaster, if you had some sort of contingency plan, if you've got a computer at home and there's a natural disaster at the office, imagine, if you will, if you were in the towers in New York that were bombed. Mm-hmm. Now, those people were out of those premises for months and months and months.
Yeah.
What would you do? I mean, most of us would hopefully have some sort of off-site backup that we've not only taken home, but that we have a resource to use them at home, so at least we have the basic records of our business on an off-site basis.
Well, that's the beauty of the computer these days, is almost everything I've got, almost everything I've got in a file in my filing cabinet is on file in my computer.
And then we talk about the ultimate worst-case scenario, Jim. What if you die? Now, for some of you, you know, the business was you and you were the business and there's no carrying on, and that's fine. Just have an executor that is business savvy enough to be able to untangle whatever's left behind by your death. But if you've got employees and people to take care of, that's a situation where, again, either an employee or a trusted relative would have some sort of ability to, number one, find your will, number two, find your keys and a spare set of passcodes, so that anything that only you knew, there is now another person that knows where to find that.
Is there anything a power of attorney would not allow them to do? I mean, could they get into your lockbox?
Not if you're dead, if you're disabled, yes.
I'm talking about, when the power of attorney would work.
Yes, when the power of attorney works, I mean, the power of attorney can be for anything and everything. Which is why it's useful but dangerous, you know.
For legal purposes, they basically become you.
Yes, that's true. They are your replacement. They can do it. They can sue on your behalf. They can sell your property. They can hire and fire your employees. You don't necessarily want this thing floating around on a day-to-day basis, because it could make your life miserable.
Right.
But on an emergency basis, to be held in escrow. And as an attorney, very often I will hold these agreements for my clients.
Well, you really want to be careful who you give that power. power of attorney.
Exactly. So what they'll say is, if you find out I'm disabled, I'm telling my nephew John to come and see you if I'm disabled.
Right.
And then, you know, they would know that I have the documents, passcodes, and keys. But you've got to keep it up to date, too. It does no good if you've got no keys to the office.
Exactly. Sarah, that's got to be the last word.
Okay.
Again, thank you very much for helping us with 101 ways to avoid liability in your small business. I'm looking forward to our next series.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, ma'am. Right. See you later. Sarah Calvert, ladies and gentlemen. Got to wrap it up for this hour. Before I go, I want to thank my heroes, small business owners, because without your courage, hard work, and devotion to your dreams, America would not be the greatest country in the world. And remember these 10 two-letter words. If it is to be, it is up to me. This is Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and this program is for you.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blassingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.